I'd like now to welcome Bill Burke-White. He's a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania, and he is our foreign correspondent. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Bill.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. It's good to be with you, as always.
And you are not only going to talk to us about foreign affairs today, but you're going to tell us a little bit about what's happening in Pennsylvania. You're there live at the Democratic primary. You're at one of the polling places.
I am, in fact, at one of the polling places this morning. I am in the 10th Ward in North Philadelphia, which is a largely African-American community, not too far from the center of Philadelphia. It is primarily an area where Barack Obama is expected to do extremely well, and I can report to you that voting has been going very smoothly, at least in this ward this morning, with hundreds of voters turning up, but lines aren't too long, and it looks like a smooth morning, at least in this part of town. There's expectations of some lines and congestion this evening in the after-work rush. Given the unprecedented number of people who have registered to vote, we are expecting a sort of onslaught of voters this evening. But at the moment, things are flowing quite smoothly.
So you have recently come back from Uganda. The subject of our conversation today is the country of Uganda. And you were actually commissioned to write a report for the government of Uganda about the peace and justice process there. How did you get involved with that?
Well, about 2 years ago, I was working for the International Criminal Court in The Hague in the Netherlands, which is prosecuting the leaders of the rebel movement, the Lord's Resistance Army in northern Uganda. And I think 2 years ago, you and I may have actually talked about my time at the International Criminal Court.
Right.
But after my work there, I was asked by the government of Uganda to assist them as they were thinking about the role of justice and accountability in Uganda. And then I went down to Uganda in August of 2006. And then last August was commissioned by the Ugandan ambassador to the Netherlands, which is where the International Criminal Court sits, to produce a report for them on the implementation of a series of agreements that they have reached with the rebels about justice and accountability. And in fact, next early in May, we will present to both the Ugandan government and the U.S. Department of State versions of this report that really looks at both the relationship between domestic trials that governments might hold after a conflict and trials before the International Criminal Court, and then also looks at the wider range of things that a country needs to do to recover from 20 years of civil war and ethnic conflict. So we're very excited that this will be going off to the government and hopefully reinvigorating a peace process that has been looking very promising over the last year or so, but hasn't been able to reach a final solution, which was supposed to lead to a signing of a peace deal at the end of last week, and did not. So it's a time to try to reinvigorate that process and see if we can move closer to both peace and justice in a very troubled part of Africa.
Tell us what the conflict in Uganda over the last 20 years has been about in the first place.
Yeah, briefly, this has been a sort of 20-year civil war that we could actually trace back even earlier to British rule, where the British colonial rulers tended to favor the southern part of the country. And then the next leader after that of any consequence was Idi Amin, the sort of horrible dictator from Uganda that many of you may have heard of. And he was from the northern part of the country and tended to support the interests of the north over those of the south. And when he fell from power, Yoweri Museveni became the new president, and he was from the south and tended to support the south over the north. And after Museveni came to power, a guy named Joseph Kony started a kind of rebel movement based in the north, pushing for kind of the rights and interests of those in the northern part of the country. But Kony was not completely rational or perhaps even sane, and he believed that he heard the word directly from God as to what he was supposed to do, and began a very violent campaign in which, sadly, the victims were largely the northern population that he was supposedly trying to assist, because the way he funded and ran his campaign over the past 20 years was essentially to go into villages in the north and kidnap boys to turn them into child soldiers to fight alongside him, and kidnap girls and young women to turn into forced wives. So you had a kind of perhaps somewhat legitimate initial cause, the sort of neglect of the north, but it ended up turning into a violent campaign in which the victims were those northern Ugandans themselves.
And so how did the conflict come to a head or come to a resolution? I mean, it's not going on in the same way that it was.
Well, it's not going on as badly as it was for quite some time, but that said, the leaders of the Lord's Resistance Army are still at large. A couple things have happened. The first and perhaps most important thing was that in 2005, the president of Uganda, who had been unable to reach a deal with these rebels or to catch them, called in the International Criminal Court and invited the International Criminal Court to open an investigation of this rebel group. And then later in 2005, the International Criminal Court indicted these rebels. And that has made it much more difficult for them to operate, made it much more costly for them to get weapons because other states no longer wanted to provide support to indicted warlords. So part of it was the role of the International Criminal Court. Another part has been a peace between the north and the south in Sudan. Of course, there still is the conflict in Darfur in the other part of Sudan. But this peace between the north and south has made it much harder for the rebels to kind of hide across the border and sneak back into Uganda to commit acts of violence. And so for the last 2 years, the Lord's Resistance Army has essentially been hiding in a national park in the eastern part of the Congo, another one of the neighboring states in that difficult part of Africa. And hiding there, they have been unable to continue inflicting violence in northern Uganda. But the fact that they're still at large and there hasn't been a peace deal means that hundreds of thousands of Ugandans are still living in internally displaced persons camps, and that life has not been able to return to normal in any sense of the word in northern Uganda.
One of the things that we have discussed before on this program, and that is very much an issue here, is the tension between peace and justice. On the one hand, there is the need to bring people to justice who've done absolutely horrible things. On the other hand, there are calls for amnesty so that people can get on with the process of peace and living in peace. Tell us more specifically what's going on there, how that plays out in Uganda.
Well, it's a really tough question because the problem is essentially this. The Ugandan government signed up to the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court that requires that the perpetrators of massive crimes face justice. Yet, and that process actually has probably made the whole peace negotiation easier in a sense, because it created a threat to the Lord's Resistance Army that if they didn't come in from the jungle and negotiate a peace, they would be sent off to The Hague and prosecuted. The problem now in the peace talks is this. The Lord's Resistance Army says, we will come in from the jungle, we will sign a peace accord, we will end the war, but only if you take away the arrest warrants from the International Criminal Court. And so Uganda finds itself at a kind of impasse. On one hand, it's obligated to the international community to prosecute these individuals or to send them off to The Hague to face prosecution. And it's probably even owes it to its own people to make sure that the perpetrators of such horrific crimes face justice. But if it wants to end the conflict and bring about an end to 20 years of civil war, it may require giving these horrible leaders amnesty and failing to fulfill an international obligation to surrender the leaders of the Lord's Resistance Army to the International Criminal Court to face prosecution. So Uganda is in a bind where on one side it has a duty to provide justice, and on the other side, bringing about peace may require sacrificing that very justice. And so where we are at the moment in the negotiations between the Ugandan government and the Lord's Resistance Army is trying to find a solution to what is essentially a deadlock between peace and justice in these negotiations.
And that falls on your shoulders, Bill Burke-White. I mean, you brought a team of law students whom you were teaching at the University of Pennsylvania to go and try to address the situation. It seems like a tension with, I mean, what's the resolution?
Well, there is no perfect resolution. And what you usually have in these debates are very categorical claims in which some people will say justice is the most important value and we have to provide justice even if it means that the war continues. And in fact, that has been the position of the International Criminal Court. The prosecutor of the court made a bold statement a few months ago in which he said essentially that the court's job was to pursue justice and that he would not bend or flex in any way based on the political situation on the ground. On the other side of this debate, you tend to have people who say, you know, justice is all well and good, but what matters most is peace. And even many of the northern Ugandans you speak to say that the most important value for them is peace and ending the war and bringing their lives back to some version of normalcy. So we have spent the past year looking hard at this question and working with the Ugandans and with the International Criminal Court have pushed the Ugandans, hopefully, in a direction that might allow you to achieve both peace and justice. And that justice may not look exactly like the justice that the International Criminal Court has in mind. But to understand the solution that we're advocating requires a little bit of background on the International Criminal Court itself and what states agreed to in 1998 when they created this new court. In the Rome Statute that established the court, states agreed, first of all, that there was an obligation to provide justice for serious and systematic international crimes, things like rape and murder conducted as part of a widespread attack on a civilian population. But the International Criminal Court itself was established to have what lawyers would call complementary jurisdiction. And what that means is that national governments are supposed to have the first obligation to prosecute international crimes themselves, and that the International Criminal Court should only step in when national governments are unable or unwilling to prosecute these crimes themselves. If you think about the number of horrific crimes around the world that happen every year, there's no way that one relatively small court in the Netherlands could provide justice for all those crimes. So the court was created to give national governments the kind of first mover advantage. Let them act first, and then the international court only steps in where national governments don't prosecute. And when Uganda called up the court back in 2005, they said to the court, hey, look, we cannot prosecute these people because they're hiding in a national park in the Congo, and we can't get our hands on them. So even if we wanted to prosecute them, we can't. And what seems to have happened now in the negotiations, and our recommendations seek to implement, is a recognition that the Ugandan government, despite having called in the International Criminal Court, still has the right to prosecute these individuals first. And so what the current negotiations are calling for is the creation of a special court in Uganda that would prosecute these individuals. And if the special court in Uganda does so, the International Criminal Court does not have the right to come in and try to prosecute these rebels themselves. What's significant about this is that the rebels, particularly their leader, Joseph Kony, has said that he might well be willing to submit to prosecution in Uganda, but certainly is not willing to submit to prosecution in the International Criminal Court. Now, that might seem a little strange because, look, why would you rather be prosecuted by your enemy, the president of Uganda, than in a neutral court in The Hague? And there's really two reasons, I think, why Kony might prefer this. The first is that the negotiations are calling for alternative sentences, sentences less than, for example, murder that would be called for under the Ugandan Penal Code. And secondly, I think Kony has a hope that perhaps a few years down the line, either President Museveni of Uganda would soften his position and perhaps pardon the rebels, or that there might be a change in power in Uganda, and as part of that power change, they might get pardoned. So Kony, I think, sees a domestic prosecution as more acceptable to him because he might end up with a lesser sentence or the chance of early release, which would not be available to him if he were prosecuted by the International Criminal Court. So what all this means is that we're suggesting to the Ugandan government that they create a special court domestically, that they accept some version of alternative sentences for the rebels, but not sentences that are so limited or so short or so weak that they would not be seen by either the Ugandan people or the International Criminal Court as a genuine effort to bring these warlords to justice. And if the Ugandans are willing to create this court and provide significant, even if alternative, sentences, there may be a way to avoid this kind of paradox between peace and justice. There would be some compromise on justice. It wouldn't look like justice in The Hague, and it might not have as long a prison term, but it would still be meaningful justice, but perhaps justice that even the indicted rebels would be willing to accept, and justice domestically that would be strong enough to keep the International Criminal Court at bay and lead to a resolution that could achieve both peace and justice.
We're talking to Bill Burke White. Now, you're talking about setting up a special court for this. How functional is the Ugandan judiciary, and how would that court be set up given the judiciary that they have?
Well, the Ugandan judiciary is actually surprisingly good, given that it's a judiciary in a relatively troubled country in Africa. It inherited its legal system from the United Kingdom. It has a functioning Supreme Court and regional courts. And the current proposals suggest that there is a special division of the High Court, of the Supreme Court, created to try a relatively small number of these rebels. There were only five people in indicted by the International Criminal Court, and only a few hundred others that are still at large. And so the number of trials would not be as many as you might have had in, say, Rwanda, where hundreds of thousands of people were engaged in the crimes. So there's reason to believe that the Ugandan judiciary can do this. Yes, they'll need some international help, perhaps some aid donations and so forth. But the Ugandan judiciary can do this as long as we can get a deal with the rebels that they submit themselves to Ugandan jurisdiction and come in from the jungle.
I have to just... as an aside, say that this is quite an education for your students. I mean, you know, people go to college, they apply to law school, they get into the University of Pennsylvania, and suddenly they're in Uganda writing documents that are incredibly important.
Well, some of your listeners may have watched a movie called The Paper Chase a long time ago, which is sort of your classic vision of what a law school curriculum is about. This is the idea that the students read the cases and come sit in the assigned seats, and the professor walks in and turns to one of them and says, "Mr. So-and-so, tell me the facts of this case," and then the professor glares at them while the student feels ashamed because he or she doesn't have the answers. Part of what we're trying to do here is say that legal education need not be that classical model. And true enough, we took a dozen students down to to Uganda. We had more than 50 interviews, ranging from the Attorney General of the country to representatives of the rebel group to child mothers in internally displaced persons camps, and then to come back from that and write a report for the government that provides meaningful policy advice is truly an extraordinary opportunity to learn, but also one that tries to integrate the education process with real life and real problems. And this has been going on in law schools, particularly on the local level, with things like tenant advocacy clinics. But what's exciting about this project is it takes it to a whole new level, where the recipient of the advice is the government of Uganda and the United States Department of State. As the professor doing this, I have been extraordinarily fortunate to be able to watch and learn from my students as their worlds were turned upside down. They went to Uganda after lots of research here with one set of ideas and conceptions of what justice meant and what peace meant and what Uganda was like, and I watched as their world was just totally flipped upside down. And that, I believe, is the true value of a modern legal education.
What do you mean flipped upside down? Like, what did they see that surprised them?
I think many of the students went in saying, you know, justice is the most important thing here. They're law students, after all. They believe in the law and in justice and in courts and in the ability of the law to build a kind of stable future. And when they talked to ordinary Ugandans and they saw the conditions on the ground, I think they saw two things. First of all, that justice is a deeply conditional concept, and that to be a lawyer in America may mean one thing, but if you're thinking about the way law works in a developing country coming out of civil war, you have to rethink those notions and probably have much more flexibility in how you see and how you envision the law working. I think the other thing that was transformed in many of their minds is this idea that trials were sufficient, that if you put these people in jail, you move beyond the conflict. And one of the things they really saw was that there were huge problems in northern Uganda that needed to be addressed, ranging from reparations to an amnesty process to a truth commission, and that all of those other elements had to be part of whatever the solution we suggested for the Ugandan government ultimately would be.
And as you've talked about, a big part of the process is a healing process, a mass collective healing process for the country. Where does your work fit in and help to foster that?
So as I was saying, you know, a trial may be a part of healing, but there's a number of things that need to get done. One of them is sort of community-level healing, right? It's fine to prosecute some people in the high court, but at the end of the day, the question is, can you live with the person who lives in the hut next to you in your village? And so we make a series of recommendations about that process of healing. Many of these countries and communities had local justice processes, often referred to as traditional justice. And traditional justice was a way that a tribe might have a healing with another tribe, or people within a tribe have some sort of healing process. And many people, particularly in the West, have said, oh, fine, just use traditional justice and everyone will be happy and healed. But as we investigated traditional justice in Uganda, we saw that it was an important part of Ugandan culture, but also a deeply troubled part. Troubled in part because women are largely excluded from the processes, and women are often the most serious victims of the kinds of crimes we're dealing with. And also troubled because every community in Uganda had its own kind of process, and you couldn't impose a sort of national traditional justice and healing. So we have suggested that the government encourage very local levels of traditional healing ceremonies, which can include bending of spears or drinking of the juice of a bitter gourd together, but that the government also provide a fund that would fund these processes only where each local community does some things to modernize their traditional justice processes. For example, allowing women to participate in the ceremonies, allowing a more open process, and making sure that one is both respecting the local history and culture, but not excluding women victims from the healing process. So we hope that the use of a fund in this way would give local communities an incentive to modernize their traditional justice processes, but not feel like they're at the sort of fiat of a national government that doesn't understand who they are, telling them what to do. So one piece of this is traditional justice, and then there's other elements that we could talk about, such as reparations and an amnesty commission that we've also recommended.
Well, we've got just about a minute left. Reparations are something that, you know, I would think would be very hard in a poor country.
It's really hard.
You know, you have hundreds of thousands of victims of crimes and a government that doesn't have the resources to build them a house or hand them a check. So we have suggested a community-based reparations process where the government actually comes into communities and apologizes for its failure to protect, you know, communities in northern Uganda from horrific crimes, and then does things on a community level rather than an individual level, like building a new school or creating a community center. But that what's critical about these reparations is the government needs to apologize for its failure to protect its own people from a horrific set of crimes that it may not have committed, but that it didn't stop.
So it's almost time to go, but what happens next? You present this report. You're going to go to Uganda again to present the report?
We're actually going to present the report via a video uplink to the Ugandan government, and hopefully it will provide some reinvigoration for the you know, not failed, but potentially failing peace negotiations. And then the real question is whether the government of Uganda is willing to take some of the hard steps that they need to, not just from our recommendations, but from a range of other sources as well, and whether the international community is willing to come in and help, and the International Criminal Court is willing to accept justice that might be a little less than they might hope, but would be compatible with a broader peace settlement. And so we'll be presenting these recommendations, and then all eyes will be on Uganda to see whether the process can move forward. It'll be a hard and long process. We don't expect immediate change because of our report, but hopefully it will be part of a broader process leading to peace and justice in northern Uganda.
Bill Burke-White is professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for joining us today on KSFR.
It's a pleasure to be with you, and good morning to all in Santa Fe. Take care.
You too.